Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, and welcome to episode 184 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and, an alternative way of living as a woman. Well, we have a terrific show with an excellent expert guest, and I just want you to know before we begin that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. Now, here's your reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. We really look forward to hearing your feedback. We sit around waiting for it, so come on down, and we'll be giving you another reminder later on after the episode. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Well, you know, how many of you out there in Her podcast land are constantly listening to stories on podcasts and magazine articles and online about women who elect to get married, partner up, have children, and that seems to be the dominant theme. But what about women who opt out of all of that? What about women who are doing other things? So what's really interesting about this is finally we have a book and an expert who can really address what happens when you say, no, I've just had a different way of looking at and reframing all of this for myself. Our expert is Glynis McNichol, and her book is No One Tells You This, a memoir. No One Tells You This. Well, what are they not telling you? Well, what's really interesting is when you have, here you are as Glynis, you know, with a great career, fulfilling personal life, and as she approached her 40th year, she was constantly reminded she had neither of the things the world expected of a woman. Her age, you know, here she is, she's 40 years old. Well, what were those things they expected? A partner or a baby? She knew she was supposed to feel bad about this, but really? Seriously? What's going on with all of this? So what she decided to do as a writer was to co-found The List. Her work has appeared in print and online for publications that include The New York Times, Forbes, The Guardian, and more. She's written a series of articles on the Brownsville neighborhood in Brooklyn for Chase's award-winning From the Ground Up. This is a package one that won a 2015 Contently Award. She's also someone who is very passionate about getting the message out there about what happens when women opt out of that traditional, if not stereotypic, role. All right, Glynis, welcome to the Herb podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So Glynis, what made you write the book? What was going on in your mind at the time? How did it kind of finally reach a point where, boom, I got to write a book?
I'm not sure it was boom so much, but I do think that, as I approached 40 and then during my 40th year, I became increasingly frustrated by the lack of narrative that, we give to women's lives. I think I was looking to my left and my right and I saw all these women I knew leading similar lives to myself, but of course I couldn't find anything remotely representing it in the culture. There was, you know, I talk a little bit about my 40th birthday, really just wanting to like sit down with a book or go to a movie that made me feel that I would like recognize myself in, and there was nothing. And so I complained about it for about a year in a number of different articles, and I finally had this moment of like, well, I am a writer. I'm complaining about the lack of stories out there. The year I'd had lent itself, I felt, to sort of a narrative arc that worked, and so I decided to turn it into a book, and I was fortunate that it had an agent and editor that agreed that it was a good idea.
And so when you wrote this book, you know, I think I read a little bit about, you know, in the beginning, in our intro, about what was going on in your life at the time. You know, this a lot of issues were now churning up. You know, you were supposed to feel bad about not having, you know, the big marriage / partner or a baby and being single. And what's going on now? And how you begin to approach that, being single, childless, and happy. Is it possible? You know, that type of thing. And so, why don't you go to that place?
I don't think it's like a long arc, right? I think a lot of women, as you go into your late 30s, increasingly feel anxiety over what we're all conditioned and taught to think our lives are supposed to look like, and what the infrastructure around those lives look like. Like, there's a real infrastructure financially and culturally around partnering up that simply doesn't exist when you're alone. And the lack of stories we have about women living on their own contribute to that, because I compare it to living without a blueprint or a map. Like, you just have no sense of what your life is supposed to look like, and that can be terrifying. So I think it just sort of, for myself and for many women I've spoken to and I'm friends with, there was just, it felt like a gauntlet. Like, the age 37 to 40 felt like you were on a countdown. And what happens to you if you don't have these things lined up? Because there's no, I mean, you can look to your left and right, and everybody's like, the thing I'm always told still, which I find amusing, is everyone's like, well, I had an aunt that didn't get married, and she, you know, she enjoyed herself. Everyone has an aunt. And I am an aunt, so I've become the aunt that everyone points to. But so I think that there's this, you know, 40 looms on our horizon for men and women, but particularly for women. We talk, you know, that is the age we attach fertility to. And I turned 40 with this sort of real sense of dread. And the result was I spent my 40th year being alternately furious that no one had prepared me for how enjoyable my life was and how exhilarating and how fun and exciting it could be. And then at the same time, resentful that no one had prepared me for the ways in which it would actually be difficult. My mother was quite ill at the time, and I was one of the primary caretakers for her, which is a lot of responsibility. And my sister was home alone with 3 kids at the time, and I was helping her. And so there was all of these responsibilities that I was shouldering that I don't think we talk about. The responsibility of women who are often the people who shoulder the family caretaking roles, particularly single women. And at the same time, I was just, you know, for the first time in my life, had some financial stability, and I was traveling a ton, and I was having all these adventures, and I was able to do what I wanted when I wanted, and I wasn't prepared for that either. So I really felt like, in good and bad ways, that the world had done nothing but teach me to dread this moment in my life, like I was going to become invisible, which that conclusion is easy to draw when you look around and don't see women's lives represented in any storytelling between the ages of 40 and 60. And I was just like, wow, this is so much better and so much harder than I thought in so many different ways. And no one told me. So I felt like this book was almost sort of like, I'm a journalist, and I felt like I was sort of sending back a report. Like, here's my dispatch from out here being 40 and single without children. And then, of course, as you say, the punchline of all this for some people in coverage of the book has been, you know, she's 40, you know, single, childless, and she's happy. Like, that's the kicker. Can you believe it? She's actually enjoying herself, which tells you a lot about how we think about women.
Yeah, a lot of that going on. You know, you really kind of bring up the whole issue in what you've said, is how you define being a complete or successful woman, right? You know, and you're in the process of redefining it. What's your redefinition?
Well, I don't know that I'm in the process of redefining it. I actually think that numbers show that I'm an increasing majority. Like, the life I'm leading is being led by large numbers of women. And that's been true in the past too. So all I'm doing is attempting to put a language to it. So I don't actually think that I'm doing anything altogether that unusual. It's just that I'm talking about it. That's the unusual part. And that was really my goal. I really felt that I was, as somebody who was a writer and who really depended on stories, that I really suffered from the lack of stories. Like, this idea that women can, and this applies to married women and mothers, like, we have this very narrow, narrow idea of what constitutes a valuable woman's life. And so I really just wanted to say, let's talk about all the other options that I'm seeing exist around me. Because it's not new. You know, Rebecca Traister wrote a book called All the Single Ladies, and she delves back in sort of the history of many movements that have been pioneered by single women. I think the difference right now, and this is an anecdote that I come back to again and again, is in the United States, women couldn't have credit cards in their own name until 1974, and which happens to be the year I was born. They had to have their husband or their father sign for them, for apartments, for credit cards, for bank accounts. And so what we're experiencing right now, I think, for the first time, is women enjoying a financial independence in ways that we never have before. And what that's leading to is women being able to decide what they want their lives to look like and then have control over that. And that's the shift. That's what I'm living. That's the difference. And that's what the difference, I think, for what many women are living right now, is that it's this sense of like, oh, I can actually decide what I like, and then I can actually make it happen, and I don't need anyone's permission to do so.
I think a lot of women like this are hiding in plain sight.
We're not hiding. It's been interesting to be putting this book out because it got a lot of attention, and it's the people, in terms of like adapting it or turning it into some sort of movie or television series, I get a lot of questions about when that's happening. And I hear a lot from people who are in those decision-making roles who are primarily men, like, oh, we don't see the hook, or we don't understand. So I don't know that we're hiding. I just think that on the larger scale of how we understand our lives, which, you know, we often look to screens or books for, no one's shown that this is a moneymaker yet. That's what's happening. I can point out women all over the place, you know. And you can point out women now who have run for office in this last election, or who we're really very quickly increasingly not talking about women in terms of their relationships and in terms of their motherhood. We still do that, but I think you can see prominent women now whose marriage or whose children are like now like the fourth line in a profile as opposed to the lead. So I think it's happening, but, you know, to speed it up a little bit.
When I said hiding, I meant it euphemistically. Meaning that
no one's
deliberately hiding. What's happening is they're all there, but no one has cared enough to be able to actually acknowledge this in a big way. Instead, mm-hmm. it's that, you know, aunt who, you know, never got married and all the rest of it. And it seems like it's a one-off. It's not. It's actually, you know, a lot of this is generational. So if you look at women over the age of 50, many of them have elected, and this is a huge tsunami of women who've elected to become single. You know, if they were, you know, partnered up, they unpartner, and then they kind of move it along here. And many of those people had been actually officially married. That's just a generational thing. As the Gen Xers and other people move up, many of them have never even gotten married, and nor do they really give a damn. One way or the other, they're kind of redefining that whole coupling process, if indeed there's going to be a coupling. But a lot of women, especially as they enter the years 50 plus, will be widows, or they will never have elected to have really had a permanent relationship with anybody. And there's a huge number of women there who are actually developing very strong networking communities, where they live together, where they thrive together, they vacation together, they travel together. There's a lot more of this kind of, a community, of women who really maintain very strong bonds and connections, to do that. So that's really cool. I think that, you know, a lot of this is also a cultural shift. I think women are now feeling a lot more courageous about literally saying, hey, I elected not to be a mother, and I elected not to get into a marriage type arrangement. So that's me, and get used to it. You know, it's like, does that make sense to you?
No, of course, but I also think that we can't untangle this from financial independence and also control over our bodies in terms of birth control. Like, this all, both of those things, sort of, there was a huge shift around both those things in the early 70s. And so what we're seeing right now is this first wave of women who are really benefiting from those changes because they've grown up with them. So when we say women are becoming widows or divorcing and remaining single in later life, like, financially, they're able to do that. I think there are many women who remarried a second time for financial security. Or we talk about women electing not to have children. Well, for however long that was, you're both financially more secure if you get married, and within a marriage, how much choice do you have? Like, I think it's very difficult to separate all of these conversations from the cultural shift is following some very practical might not be the right word, but shifts in how women are being allowed to live their lives. Like, if you financially do not have to be in a marriage to survive, it's interesting to watch how many women are choosing not to be in a marriage and then really question why so many women, like, women had to be married in order to survive in many cases. So all of this is hugely fascinating, and the culture is following up on all of this. So we are finally creating a culture in which we celebrate these things as opposed to punish them. But at the same time, how many women, I often think of, like, I mean, our grandmother's generation, like, how many of those women would have chosen not to have children if they'd had the option? And how many of those women would have chosen not to get married if they had the option? Those options were far less available. And of course, there were single mothers and single women, but that was not, they suffered, you know, they were punished in the way they lived for living that way, whether by choice or whether it was just by circumstance that they were there. So it's all, I think, enmeshed together in really, really fascinating ways that we're still trying to understand, and that the culture is still trying to catch up with in terms of, you know, explaining it back to us.
Yeah, I know. It's really interesting. What we're butting our heads up against at times are cultural beliefs and, you know, cultural definitions of the worth and the value of a woman. And,
mm-hmm.
you know,
well, then we,
go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, when you say the value of a woman, and then I always think, like, who, the value of a woman to whom? Because who gets to determine the value of the what a woman is? And historically, it's been men, because of course men were the one making the laws, and men still to this day are the ones sort of, when we talk about the Me Too movement in Hollywood or needing to change diversity and directors and all of this, like, men are the ones creating or greenlighting these stories. So the cultural value of a woman has been determined by how they are valuable to men. And I think what we're seeing now, again, is women being able to determine the cultural value of themselves and how we value ourselves versus how men value us. It's all confusing, too. I mean, it's enormously confusing and fraught and difficult to go through. I myself feel it all the time. I mean, it's not like I am rewarded for not being married or not having a child. There's no real celebration around my life. There's not a ritual around single women's lives that says to them, you know, congratulations on this milestone. There are no milestones. So we're just like, it's still difficult, but it's changing. It's definitely changing. And I think it's always, on book tour and a lot of the events I've done, a lot of women have spoken to me, younger women, about the shame they feel when they're eating alone, or the shame they feel when they're traveling alone. I just always like to emphasize, like, what is that to be ashamed about, and who's making you feel ashamed by it? Like, who benefits from you feeling bad about being by yourself?
That's so terribly interesting. You know, when you said that, I was just thinking to myself, I was at a business luncheon, and it was actually at a restaurant, very, very nice restaurant. And I noticed that there were, you know, a number of couples, you know, who were also eating. And I'm telling you right now, there's nothing that's, you know, stranger in my mind than watching a couple who doesn't even talk to each other. You know, yeah, it's weird. It's like, you know, girlfriend, you might as well be alone. You haven't said word one to him. And it's almost like they're tolerating each other's existence, or they've just sort of evolved into nothingness. I mean, there's just like come on, there's got to be something to talk about. This is Washington, D.C., for God's sake. You know, I mean, let's just talk about the administration. Let's have some fun here.
Right.
Nothing. And I'm staring at it. I see it all the time. Raise your hand out there in podcast land. Yeah. See, I told you. We've all seen it. And I always swore to myself, I mean, shoot me if that ever happens to me. I just, what is the point? It's like a facade. You know, you might as well be by yourself reading a good book, you know, at that particular place, wherever you're eating or back and forth. Glynis, you know, I know that our podcast listeners here would love to know just one thing, because I asked a bunch of people about this before, you know, I did the podcast, and something they were really wondering about is, was this a deliberate decision on your part in the sense that did you sort of say to yourself, you know, I just don't feel the urge to do the whole mother thing, and the child thing. And so I'm not going to, you know, go to that place. Or did you stumble into it? Or was this, how well thought out was this in your mind? Or was this a natural, organic evolution of your life?
You know, I think there are some women out there, I really do think there's like a small amount of women out there who know from an early age, or who clearly decide that they don't want to have kids. That was not me, and that's very few women that I know. I think I talk about this in the book, in the chapter where I'm with my newborn nephew, but I think I got to 40, and there had always been this assumption on my part, just like a default assumption, like, oh, you know, this'll happen, or like, I hadn't really interrogated it. I'd been so ambitious in my 30s and working really hard, and I turned 40 and my sister had my youngest nephew and I was sitting with him. And again, I spend tons of time with children. My life is full with children. So it wasn't like, children were alien to me. It was sort of like, well, this will eventually happen to me, I guess. And I was sitting with him shortly after my 40th birthday and I thought, I really need to look this in the face and decide if it's something I want. Because if I want this, I'm 40 and I need to figure out how to get it now. Like this is not going to like roll in for me without some effort or some really clear cut decision making. And so I spent a lot of time when I was at home, that month, like literally, I call it the showdown, but I would literally sit on the couch with this perfect newborn in my lap and stare at him and be like, are you going to be okay if you don't have this? Or do you want this? And really asking myself that direct question. And I just kept coming back to the fact that I didn't want it enough. That was the answer. Like, I didn't want it enough to go and make it happen. I was going to be fine without kids. And that, I think, is a closer description. I always say I'll be okay without kids is a far more accurate way to talk about not having children than to say I don't want kids. I love kids. I mean, I spend time every single day with children. I live upstairs from two of my godchildren. So none of these questions, I think we do ourselves a disservice when we talk about them in such black and white terms. So I think I got to that point and I thought, do I want a child badly enough to shift all the things in my life that are going to need to be shifted to change this all around and to chase this down? And for some women, the answer to that question is yes. And those women, we all know those women too. And I have great empathy for them and admiration. If you decide that at age 40, you want a kid and that's your number one goal. I mean, all good luck and best wishes to you. I just decided it wasn't. And I do think so. I was having this conversation with a friend the other day, that it's a question I'm continually asking myself. I'm 44 now and I still walk up to the line every once in a while and think, are you sure about this? Cause I also like to talk about like getting pregnant and being a mother are two very different things. You can be, motherhood is not contingent on pregnancy. So there are many ways to be, say you change your mind at age 50, there are certainly ways in which you can explore having children in your life or being a mother. But like at that moment, I really had to say to myself, if you want to get pregnant and have a kid, now's the time. And I didn't want it badly enough. And I still don't want it badly enough. So that's the answer. That is how I came up with it.
Well, that's a beautiful and very thorough way of dealing with it. I mean, I love it. I totally love it. Now, my question to you, the final one, is how did you look at it in terms of a partner? Some women define themselves by a guy or a partner in general. Doesn't have to be a guy. So where did your head go with that? because again, you know, and I know that this is a big deal in with women. They sit back and they have to think about this. Like, do I really need, what does a partner bring to the table? Where am I with this need for a partner? You know, just give us a little hint about where your whole, trajectory has been with that.
So I do think there are many people in life who do well in relationships and partnerships. They just operate from a stronger place in a partnership. I am not one of those people. I've certainly never been one of those people. And what was interesting to me, especially in hindsight, is watching myself in my late 30s, thinking I was supposed to be in a relationship, try and really, you know, a square peg in a round hole myself into increasingly appropriate relationships. And I often, and the ironic thing and the confusing thing is it's very easy, and I've certainly been spoken to like this by people, to say like, oh, you missed your opportunity, or it just didn't happen for you. And I often think, no, it's just that I didn't push the bad relationship I was in down the aisle because I prioritized marriage over happiness. That's the difference. I could very easily have been married and, you know, in a terrible relationship, as I know many people who are, because I prioritized the need to be in a marriage over the need to feel okay with my life. But that was a long, hard lesson to learn. And I think, again, there was a point, and it was all tied up with like, do I want to be a parent? And if I want to be a parent, do I want to be a parent alone? Because there was a point where I just thought like, my life, we have to talk about women's lives who are outside of marriage or outside of motherhood as like something that happened to them. Like, oh, I'm so sorry. Sorry about your luck, or sorry about your bad decision making. Like, if this is a bad outcome. And I really had this moment where I just really took my life into account, and I thought, my life didn't happen by accident. I very intentionally created the life that I wanted, and I like my life. And understanding that these things hadn't just happened to me, that I'd made conscious choices about the way I wanted to live and what made me, satisfied me the most, and that was being by myself, which is never, like, I always say these things, and I'm like, and then cut to 5 years later, she's like walking down the aisle. Like, who knows what could happen? But I really do, I'm very, very comfortable with the fact that I am more comfortable on my own than I am in a relationship. And certainly there's cultural messaging to make you feel bad about that. And there's also, like, it's hard to be alone sometimes, just like it's really hard to be in a marriage sometimes. So these things have, you know, pluses and minuses. It's just, we don't tend to credit single women with the ability to enjoy themselves. In much the same way, we don't allow married women with children to be unhappy, you know, culturally. It's two sides of the same coin, I think.
I love the way you put that, and I think that that's an important thing to look at. Look, at the end of the day, happiness is defined, you know, by a wide spectrum of different ways to live. It's not just, as you said, it's not black and white, you know, and I think that you have a long, wonderful life, knock on wood. Many things may happen. Who knows? It is what it is. And the bottom line is, you define your own happiness, and not falling prey to having to, you know, comply with cultural norms to be able to find that happiness where it may not be found. You know, that's something you have to really come to grips with. That's what a lot of people have to
do. And it's
do.
Hard. It's definitely so, not easy. It's not it's not an easy thing. So it's hard to not see yourself reflected in the culture for anybody.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. Well,
yeah,
you know,
it's very difficult.
Well, one of my people once said, you know, the loneliest I've ever felt in my whole life was actually in my marriage. And that marriage ended. I mean, you know, so this whole issue of, you know, happiness, and by definition, you're going to not be lonely because you have someone there. Maybe not so much. Look, some marriages are incredibly happy. Some partnerships, whatever they may be, are ridiculously happy. Some people just do perfectly fine. I always smile about someone I've admired forever and a day, and that's Georgia O'Keeffe, who made certain that Stieglitz never once came to New Mexico to visit her. That was her place, man. And when she wanted to ever see him, she would float into New York. And then, of course, he helped her get in all those galleries. But then he was gallivanting off doing stupid things. And then she was spending, you know, forever doing her thing in New Mexico, just perfectly content. She never had anything traditional, but then again, she was forgiven because she was so famous and whatever. It's just hysterical. I'm sorry, but I just think that everyone should know that there's a monster spectrum.
There is, and it's funny you mention her because I do, there's that old trope of like the bachelor who's finally tamed by his wife and she has to like clean up after him when they get married because he's used to living alone. And I'm like, the modern day version of that is women who get married in their 40s after being so accustomed to having their own space and having to learn to share that space with a partner. I have many friends who've gone through that. And I always think when I'm dating someone, like, I don't know, do I want you in my apartment? I don't like sharing my space. Like, it's something we don't talk about in terms of women, but it's a real thing of, I'm not sure I want to share my space with anyone. In a very practical way, I'm like, I like my space. Why are you here?
Well, I'm also going to tell you one other, you know, incredible relationship as we draw this to a close. And this is a very famous, very wealthy, sort of corporate tycoon, who ended up partnering up with an extraordinary woman, a real icon in the spa industry. And it was really interesting the way they did their thing. And that is they lived in the same city, but they never lived in the same house. It was hysterical. So what would happen is they just worked a deal, you know, during the week. He would come over if he wanted to visit her during, you know, Monday through Friday. From Friday night until, you know, Sunday night, she would be more than happy to maybe populate his place here, there, and everywhere. They travel together, this and that. And they actually never married until much later on. And that was done primarily so that she could run his foundation when he passed away, because he was about 20 years older than she was. And they were both you know, quite a bit older when all this was going on. But they never lived together. It was hysterical. She was like, I like my house. You know, I have a gorgeous place. I fixed it up myself. Don't mess with it. And then, of course, he's got this thing that's like a museum. And he's like, well, you know, you can come over anytime. She goes, yeah, well, thanks for sharing. And she just did her own thing. I watched this and I just fell off the couch laughing just because it was beautiful, creative, individual. It was a beautiful nuance to the whole thing. And guess what? At the end of the day, they defined their own happiness. That was the most important thing. And they never fell for any, you know, stupid cultural definition of anything. Listen, everyone out there in her podcast land, I want to make sure you run out and grab this book. It's written by Glynis McNichol, and that's G-L-Y-N-N-I-S, McNichol, and that's M-A-C-N-I-C-O-L, McNichol. And the name of the book is No One Tells You This. And there's a colon, a memoir. You better go get it because no one tells you this. I just told you that. And Glynis, I cannot begin to thank you enough for being on this show. What an eye opener. Man, I could go on forever and a day. And if my producers don't shoot me in the head, I probably would. So Glynis, thank you so much for being on the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Loved it.
This was
awesome,
great.
Awesome. And everyone out there right now, run on over to iTunes, rate and review the show because, man, this was so good. I mean, I know you were taking lots of notes. I know. And you're going to run out and get the book too. Yeah. I know about that too. So please rate and review. Run on over to iTunes because I'm sitting here twiddling my thumbs waiting to hear from you. Hey, everyone out there, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peake or Twitter at Pam Peake MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. And listen, stay well.